Hello, welcome.
Sorry.
My name is Michael Rodriguez. I'm a librarian here at Michigan State University Libraries. I'm the subject collector for English and American Literature, amongst other things. And one of the things I do is actually curate the series for the Michigan Writers Series, of which this event is of. Is that right? I have a PhD in English.
If you don't know, I don't know.
So I just wanted, if you have any questions about library collections in terms of the research in American and English literature, I'm more than welcome to answer what I can. I'm pretty easy to find in terms of my email address on the library webpages, so just fire away. All of our events for the Michigan Writers Series are recorded and streamed out of the catalog, and actually there's a Michigan Writers Series page as well, but if you look up, for instance, very soon, the works of authored by Marge Piercy, you'll see a link to the Michigan Writers Series. And I think you did one before, too. So there should be several of those in the catalog. I first want to just very briefly thank the co-sponsors for the event, who are the Center for Gender and Global Context, the Women's Resource Center, MSU Department of History, Writing Center, the Residential College of Arts and Humanities, and the MSU Department of English, and especially Lisa Fine, who wrote just about every single person on campus to have this co-sponsored and happen. So thanks to Lisa. Just a quick mention that books are for sale in the back of the room from Schuller's Books. And they're special because this book is not actually on the market yet. So Schuller's got a special they got a special deal where they got the books in advance. And so if you don't buy them tonight, you have to wait till they come out at the end of the month. So there you go. So Sharon Laidenson, who's a librarian at Michigan State University Libraries, and is the librarian for gender studies, amongst other things, will introduce Margie Piercy. Please welcome Sharon.
Thanks, Michael. As Michael said, I'm Sharon Laidenson. I'm the Gender and Communication Studies Librarian here at Michigan State. And I am, of course, extremely pleased and honored to have the opportunity to introduce Marge Piercy tonight. I want to just again thank our co-sponsors, most especially Lisa Fine and the Jensen for all of their extremely hard work and wonderful support in making this event happen. Born in Detroit, Michigan, Marge Piercy started writing fiction and poetry at age 15 when her family moved to a house where she had her own room and consequently private space to fuel the creative process. In her essay, "The City is Battleground, the Novelist is Combatant," Piercy notes that growing up in the diverse and tumultuous city of Detroit made her a novelist. She gives her mother credit with making her a poet as a curious and well-read woman who encouraged her daughter to read voraciously and to observe sharply. Marge Piercy did her undergraduate work at the University of Michigan, earned her Master of Arts degree at Northwestern University, and is the recipient of 4 honorary doctorates. She has taught, read, and lectured at over 400 institutions within the United States and internationally. She has earned more than a dozen awards for her writing, including a National Endowment for the Arts Award and a Literature Award from the Massachusetts Governor's Commission on the Status of Women. As a writer, Marge Piercy is highly versatile and prolific. She has produced 17 novels, more than 17 volumes of poetry, including 19 volumes, so more than 17, so 19 volumes of poetry, including her new work out this year and available again for sale in the back, made in Detroit, and a collection of short stories called The Cost of Lunch, etc., which was recently published in the summer of 2014. She also has 4 nonfiction books, including a memoir called Sleeping with Cats, and I know many of my librarian colleagues would certainly appreciate that title. Marge Piercy has skillfully written works of many genres, including historical fiction, such as the New York Times bestseller Gone to Soldiers, which takes place during World War II, and science fiction, such as He, She, and It, which won the Arthur C. Clarke Award for Best Science Fiction in the United Kingdom. As a feminist writer, she deftly captures the diversity of women's experiences in her novels, personally and politically. One example among many others is the national bestseller Braided Lives, which explores the challenges experienced by women coming of age in Detroit in repressive conditions during the 1950s. One thing that really strikes me about Marge Piercy's fiction is how real her characters are. As Jeanette Rodriguez says in the preface to an interview with Piercy, quote, The women in her fiction are drawn with such immediacy and empathy that you often recognize in their life decisions people or situations you have known, unquote. Her politics are also evident in her poetry. As Eleanor Bender notes in her essay, Visions of a Better World, the poetry of Marge Piercy, quote, perhaps more than any other poet of her generation, Marge Piercy is most explicit in confronting the political, social, and economic realities of her time. A poet of conscience, Piercy does not separate politics from her life or her life from her poetry. Marge Piercy's commitment to social justice for women and others is not only evident in her writing, but also through her involvement as a political organizer in progressive social movements, including the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, Students for a Democratic Society, and the second wave feminist movement. More recently, she has participated in resistance to the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. She has also become active in the women's movement on Cape Cod, where she has lived since 1971. The Boston Globe refers to Marge Piercy as, quote, not just an author, but a cultural touchstone. Few writers in modern memory have sustained her passion and skill for creating stories of consequence. And again, we are just so pleased to have her here tonight to read a selection of her poetry. And with that, I am honored to give the floor over to Marge Piercy.
Thank you.
You people have such nice weather here. Is this on? I'm not kidding. It snows every day this winter. Every day. Sometimes it's a foot, sometimes it's just 6 inches. Every day. We've never seen anything like it, and we don't want to see it again. This is the oldest poem that I read regularly. It's called To Be of Use. It's had a strange afterlife, being read at memorials for activists, radical lawyers, etc. The people I love the best jump into work head first without dallying in the shallows and swim off with sure strikes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black, sleek heads of seals, bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the muck and the mud to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud, botched it smears the hands, crumbles to dust. But the thing worth doing, well done, has a shape that satisfies clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry and a person for work that is real. Now, how can you hear me at the back? Okay. I love it when I say, can you hear me? And someone in the front row says, yes. What are big girls made of? The construction of a woman. A woman is not made of flesh, of bone and sinew, belly and breasts, elbows and liver and toe. She is manufactured like a sports sedan. She is retooled, refitted, and redesigned every decade. Cecile had been seduction itself in college. She wriggled through bars like a satin eel, her hips promising, her mouth pursed in the dark red lipstick of desire. She visited in the late 60s, still wearing skirts tight to the knees, while I danced through Manhattan in miniskirt, lipstick pale as apricot milk, hair loose as a horse's mane. Oh dear, I thought in my superiority of the moment. Whatever has happened to poor Cecile? She was out of fashion, out of the game, disqualified, disdained, dismembered from the club of desire. Look at pictures in French fashion magazines of the 18th century, century of the ultimate lady, fantasy wrought of silk and corseting. Panniers brought her hips out 3 feet each way, while the waist is pinched and the belly flattened under wood. The breasts were stuffed up and out, offered like apples in a bowl. The tiny foot is encased in a slipper never meant for walking. On top is a grandiose headache, hair like a museum piece, daily ornamented with ribbons, vases, grottos, mountains, frigates in full sail, balloons, baboons. The fancy of a hairdresser turned loose. The hats were rococo wedding cakes that would dim the Las Vegas Strip. Here is a woman forced into shape, rigid exoskeleton, torturing flesh, a woman made of pain. How superior we are now. See the modern woman, thin as a blade of scissors. She runs on a treadmill every morning. And fits herself into machines of weights and pulleys to heave and grunt. An image in her mind she can never approximate, a body of rosy glass that never wrinkles, never grows, never fades. She sits at the table, closing her eyes to food, hungry, always hungry, a woman made of pain. A cat or dog approaches another. They sniff noses, they sniff behinds, they bristle or lick. They fall in love as often as we do, but they fall in love or lust with furry flesh, not silicone breasts or push-up bras, rib removal or liposuction. It is not for male or female dogs that poodles are clipped to topiary hedges. If only we could like each other raw. If only we could love ourselves like healthy babies burbling in our arms. If only we were not programmed and reprogrammed to need what is sold us. Why should we want to live inside ads? Why should we want to scourge our softness to straight lines like a Modigliani painting? Why should we punish each other with scorn? As if to have a large ass were worse than being greedy or mean. When will women not be compelled to view their bodies as science projects, gardens to be weeded, dogs to be trained? When will a woman cease to be made of pain? If you still feel like doing that at the end, that would be nice. But if you do it and then sometimes you don't do it, it's very depressing. This is the title poem of my book, which I saw for the first time. This is about 2 days ago. Made in Detroit. I love this. I think it's the most beautiful of all my books, with Laurie Nix. Graphics on the cover. Made in Detroit. My first lessons were kisses and a hammer. I was fed with mother's milk and rat poison. I learned to walk on a tightrope over a pit where snakes' warnings were my rattles. The night I was born, the sky burned red over Detroit and sirens sharpened their knives. The elms made tents of solace over grimy streets and alley cats purred me to sleep. I dived into book and their fables closed over my head and hid me. Libraries were my cathedrals, librarians my priests promising salvation. I was formed by beating like a blacksmith's sword, and my edge is still sharp enough to cut both you and me. I sought love in dark and dusty corners, and sometimes I even found it, however briefly. Every harsh, every tender word entered my flesh and lives there still, bacteria in my gut. I suckled Detroit's steel tits. When I escaped to college, I carried it with me, shadow and voice pressure that hardened me to coal and flame. This is a true poem, a day in the life. She is wakened at 4 a.m. Of course, she does not pick up, but listens through the answering machine to the male voice promising she will burn in hell. At 7, she opens her door. A dead cat is hammered to her porch, brown tabby, hit by a car, no collar. She hugs her own Duke of Orange. She cannot let him out. She has her car locked in a neighbor's garage, safe from pipe bombs, but she must walk there. She drives to work a circuitous route. Outside the clinic, three men walk in circles with photos of six-month fetuses. They surround her car. They are forbidden the parking lot, but the police don't care. They bang on her hood. As she gets out, they bump and jostle her. One thrusts his sign into her face. She protects her eyes. Something hard strikes her back. Inside, she sighs, turns on the lights, the air conditioning, the coffee machine. The security system is always on. The funds for teenage contraception gone into metal detectors. She answers the phone. Is this where you kill babies? The second call, a woman is weeping. The day begins. A girl raped by her stepfather, a harried mother with too many children and diabetes, a terrified teenager who does not remember how it happened, a woman with an injunction against an abuser. All day she takes their calls. All day she checks them in, takes medical histories, holds hands, dries tears, hears secrets and lies and horrors, soothes, continues. Every time a new patient walks in, a tinny voice whispers, "Is this the one carrying a handgun with an automatic weapon, with a knife?" She sits exposed. She answers the phone. "I'm going to cut your throat, you murderer." She says, "Have a nice day." A bomb threat is called in. She has to empty the clinic. The police finally come. There is no bomb. The doctor tells her how they are stalking his daughter. Then she goes home to Duke, eats a late supper by the TV. Her mother calls. Her boyfriend comes over. She cries in his arms. He is, she can tell, getting tired of her tears. Next morning, she rises and day falls on her like a truckload of wet cement. This is a true story. This is what I know of virtue. This is what I know of goodness in our time. I want that one. I have to find it. Let's see. Let's meet in a restaurant. Is food the enemy? Giving a dinner party has become an ordeal. I lay awake the night before figuring how to produce a feast that is vegan, gluten-free, macrobiotic, avoiding all acidic fruit and tomatoes, wine, all nuts, low carb, and still edible. Are beetles okay for vegans? Probably not. Forget chocolate ants or fried grasshoppers. Now my brains are cooked. Finally, 7 o'clock arrives, and I produce the perfect meal. At each plate for supper, a bowl of cleanly washed pebbles. Enjoy. Ethics for Republicans. An embryo is precious. A woman is a vessel. A fertilized egg is a person. A woman is indentured to it. An embryo is sacred until birth. After that, he, she is on their own. Abortion is murder. Rape, incest are means to an end. That precious fertilized egg housed in an expendable body. Let us make babies and babies and babies. Children are something else. Probably future criminals. Probably welfare cheats, whose education hikes taxes. You can freely dispose of them. Let's see, are you legal yet? Can people get married here who love each other? Okay, then I'm gonna read this one. Massachusetts was the first. And I'm telling you, we've all survived. Though, of course, I'm sure there's some preacher down in Georgia saying, they're getting, God is getting them with us now. You know that's true. Deadlock, wedlock. Marriage is one man and one woman. They say one at a time, then another, another. You see the buff faces of old men shining with money as they lead their young blondes and toddlers, second or third families, the shop-worn wives donated to Goodwill. It has always been so, they say, one man and one woman in the Bible, like Jacob with Leah and Rachel and the two bondmaidens dropping children, his four women competing to swell like a galaxy of moons. In Tibet, women had various husbands at once. I had two myself for a few years. In earlier times and different cultures, men married men and women married women, and the sky didn't fall. People loved as they would and must, and the river still ran clean, and the grass grew a lot harder and more abundantly than it does with us. What damage does love do in the soft gray evenings when the rain drifts like pigeon feathers across the sky and into the trees? Why, gentlemen, do you fear two women who walk holding hands with their child? Two 50-year-old men exchange rings and kiss, and you catch mad cow disease as fallout? What do you hate when you watch lovers? What are you really missing? She held forth. Let's see, where is that? 14. She turned 14. Here we go. The neighborhood women always came to my mother, never she to them. Salesmen, solicitors, invited couples rang the front doorbell. The women came to the grade door in the yard, following the cracked cement walk around the asbestos siding, then knocking, calling, Bert, my mother's full name, or softening it to Bertie, Bertie. She would summon them up the steps to the kitchen, past rows of shoe polish and garden tools on the shelf to the side, into the kitchen with worn yellow linoleum and oilcloth-covered table. She would serve tea or lemonade, and they would hold out their palms to her, hands cracked or water softened with labor, a few manicured, some twisted with arthritis to gnarled burls. She would study their palms, and then she would tell them what was and what would be, what to fear and what to avoid, and sometimes promises or windfalls or even love. Again and again they came, as if she could change their futures. Sometimes she'd give them folk remedies for ailments they would not tell the doctor or hadn't money for him. At four, she'd shoo them out because what she feared might come at any moment, my father's bolt of temper and acid mockery. She wiped the table and set it. Where is that? I want to find it. Let's see. There's enough of you in here who are old enough to remember the golden days of housework. The good old days at home, sweet home. On Monday, my mother washed. It was the way of the world, all those lines of sheets flapping in the narrow yards of the neighborhood, the pulleys stretching out second and third floor windows. Down in the dank, steamy basement, wash tubs vast and gray, the wringers sliding between the washer and each tub. At least every year, she or I caught a hand in it. Tuesday, my mother ironed. One iron was the mangle. She sat at it feeding in towels, sheets, pillowcases. The hand ironing began with my father's underwear. She ironed his shorts. She ironed his socks. She ironed his undershirts. Then came the shirts, a half hour to each, the starch boiling on the stove. I forgot bluing. I forgot the props that held up the lines clattering down. I forgot chasing the pigeons that shat on her billowing house dresses. I forgot clothespins in the teeth. Tuesday, my mother ironed my father's underwear. Wednesday, she mended darned socks on a wooden egg. Shined shoes. Thursday, she scrubbed floors, put down newspapers to keep them clean. Friday, she vacuumed, dust, polished, scraped, waxed, pummeled. How did you become a feminist? Interviewers always ask, as if to say, when did this rare virus attack your brain? It could have been Sunday when she washed the windows, Thursday when she burned the trash, bought groceries, hauling the heavy bags home. It could have been any day she did again and again what time and dust obliterated at once till stroke broke her open. I think it was Tuesday when she ironed my father's shorts. For your information, from your pharmacist, do not take this medicine with dairy products. Do not take this medicine with any medication containing aluminum, calcium, bismuth, iron, or zinc. Do not take this product with vitamins or minerals. This medicine may cause dry mouth or arrhythmia. This medicine may cause diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, hair loss, dizziness, sore joints. This medicine may cause insomnia. Discontinue this medicine if you black out frequently, if your heart stops, or if you cannot breathe for half an hour. Discontinue if death ensues. Otherwise, take four a day. Continue until medication is completely consumed, or you are. I hope you understand there is no such thing as a side effect. Absolutely not. Okay, whoops. I will find it in 1 second. The Tao of touch. What magic does touch create that we crave it so that babies do not thrive without it? The nurse who cuts tough nails and sands calluses on the elderly tells me that sometimes men weep as she rubs lotion on their feet. Yet the touch of a stranger, the bumping or predatory thrust in the subway is like a slap. We long for the familiar, the open palm of love, its tender fingers. It's our hands that tamed cats into pets, not our food. The widow looks in the mirror, thinking, no one will ever touch me again. Never. Not hold me, not caress the softness of my breasts, my inner thighs, the swell of my belly. Do I still live if no one knows my body? We touch each other so many ways, in curiosity, in anger, to command attention, to soothe, to quiet, to rouse, to cure. Touch is our first language, and often our last, as the breath ebbs and a hand closes our eyes.
What was the name of that poem?
What poem?
That you just read.
The Tao of Touch.
Thank you.
I'm looking for what I want. Okay. City bleeding. Oh, my city of origin, city who taught me about class and class warfare, who informed me how to survive on your ash-gray burning streets when, as a Jew, I was not white yet, easy among friends of all colors. How you have been plundered. Picked and pitted rusting bones. Around you squat suburbs that never saw a rat or woke to sirens cutting machete wounds through the night, whose lush lawns are fertilized by your jobs exported to China, by bodies of desperate murders. The sand is fertile. 2 years after fire leaves a blackened pit, bushes are already sprouting among blue and gold wildflowers. In blocks of zombie houses, crack houses, walls of gang graffiti, where packs of wild dogs turn to wolves and the police never come. People still try, with little help, to remake community, to reach up and out of rubble into some venue of light, of warmth, of dignity, into whatever peace they can imagine. Out of ruins eerie in their torn decay, where people live, work, dreamed, something yet begins to rise and grow. Our never-ending entanglement. Where's water? I know water's here somewhere. Ah, good. Here we go. How long do we mourn our mothers? Unfinished business, unspoken sentences that burn in the night, tangled thickets of stymied love, steps worn smooth with scrubbing, never to be climbed again. We mourn our mothers till we ourselves are out of breath. That umbilical cord between us never really cut, no matter how hard we tried in adolescence to sever it. Once it was warm milk in a sweet stream. Once it was a brush stroking through my long hair. Once it was a lap. Once it was a slap. Shards of glass. Will anyone ever come as close or push as hard? As we age, we see your face mirrored. Your diseases weaken us. Your silences haunt. Your stories echo. We feared becoming our mothers, yet when we were not you, we felt guilty. You made us even when you hated the results, for you opened your fists and off we flew. This poem is about the ocean, but it could be about the Great Lakes as much. In storms, I can hear the surf a mile away. You may love the ocean, never boring, always in motion, sliding up the shingle, then sucked back in, waves with manes of white lions lashing at the shore, waves standing like a bear tearing at the dunes. You may love the ocean, but it does not love you back. It would as soon eat you as keep you afloat. Perhaps it loves the great wall, the great whales. Perhaps it likes walruses, but it's always hungry. You may love the ocean like my friend who at 80 will go far out twice a day if he can get a tourist to pay the gas. He likes to be out of sight of land. The sea lurks under his boat waiting. The ocean is always beautiful here in all weathers it churns up. It does not approve of land and wants to take it back. Someday it will. Even the hill I live on, sandy bottom, tides will stir the ashes of my mother and the tiny bones of my cats. My grave will be home to crabs. Who is to say that it is not just that the sea take into itself what long ago it gave us. I'm looking for what I want. Colors passing through us. Purple is tulips in May, mauve into lush velvet. Purple is the stained blackberry's leave on the lips and the hands, the purple of ripe grapes, sunlit and warm as flesh. Every day I will give you a color like a new flower in a bud vase on your desk. Every day I will paint you as women color each other with henna and hands and feet. Red as henna, as cinnamon, as coals after the fire is banked, the cardinal and the feeder, roses tumbling on the arbor, their weight bending the wood, the red of the syrup I make from their petals. Orange is a perfume fruit hanging their globes on the glossy tree. Orange is pumpkins in the field. Orange is butterfly weed and the monarchs who come to eat it. Orange is my cat running lithe through the high grass. Yellow is a goat's wise and wicked eyes. Yellow is a hill of daffodils. Yellow is dandelions by the highway. Yellow is butter and egg yolks. Yellow is a school bus stopping you. Yellow is a slicker in a downpour. Here is my bouquet. Here is a sing-song of all the things you make me think of. Here is oblique praise for the height and depth of you and the width, too. Here is my box of new crayons at your feet. Green is mint jelly. Green is a frog on a lily pad twanging. The green of coast lettuce upright, about to bolt into opulent towers. Green is Grand Chartreuse in a clear glass. Green is wine bottles. Blue is cornflowers, delphiniums, bachelor's buttons. Blue is Roquefort. Blue is saga. Blue is still water. Blue is the eyes of a Siamese cat. Blue is shadows on new snow, as a spring azure sipping from a puddle on the blacktop. Cobalt is the midnight sky when day has gone without a trace, and we lie in each other's arms, eyes shut and fingers open, and all the colors of the world pass through our bodies like strings of fire. Hannah told me stories. You told me tales, and Hannah's my grandmother. You told me tales half in Yiddish, half in English, thick and lumpy as potato soup, stories of golems, magical rabbis who could fly, but of your life before you escaped, the hatred, the hunger turned your belly to an angry dog with sharp teeth, the pogroms that took your best friend lying raped and cut open in the street with her skirt flipped over her face. You said little, almost nothing. Zeta told my mother some of it third hand to me since he'd grown up in St. Petersburg, where his brother hid his religion to dance ballet at the Mariinska. You told me of your father, the rabbi, of the little wooden shul in the Pale of Settlement, how he forbade your marriage and finally performed it, but not of how he died stripped naked, lying shot in the ditch with all his other children and the men and women who came to worship with him. No, you told me romantic tales of heroic Jewish women saving their families, of Dybbuk's and Lilith and how to ward off the evil eye and salve a wound, but never of how the Pinkertons killed your husband, how you wed finally another man you didn't love to feed your 11 children. You listened to soap operas while sewing for money. You loved romance, but life gave you blood and bones that would have burned your lips to speak. Afternoon of a House Cat. This is my cat called Zena. The cat lies sprawled in a patch of sun in the bay window, a little bored but otherwise content. She watches a small beige moth flickering about. She considers chasing it, but she has caught many moths and they are a mouthful of dust. Her tail twitches with indecision, her eyelids close. If she cannot see the moth, she need not decide. The sun is a mother who caresses her. Once she was cold, but now she is warm. Once she was hungry and would have chased the moth to have anything in her belly. Once she slept on gravel and under bushes. This all belongs to me, she thinks. The woman, the man, the other cat too young not to be stupid. The dish that fills with food twice a day. The bed where I climb after the big ones sleep to find warmth. All is good and she will spare the moth because she doesn't need it. She has everything she needs. Nice words for ugly acts. Downsizing. It sounds like losing weight. Who in this body craze society doesn't dream of getting skinny? But although corporations are now people and surely count more in elections than our lowly bodies, that weight is individuals whose families depend on those wages now about to lose their homes. Outsource sounds so bland and tidy. Nobody can hear the snap of breaking lives. Someone who had pride in his or her job well done reduced to greeting at Walmarts or flipping burgers. Or worse, nothing at all but the TV all day with depression moving in like an unwanted dirty tenant who pays no rent. These decisions are made invisibly. Unlike the overseer who wielded a whip, unlike the pirate with his cannons, unlike even the mugger out of the dark, faceless executives in their towers mete out slow death, hunger, murder of family, heart attack and stroke with a stroke of a computer key. Upkept, unkept at last. The first flakes of the year wandered down big and languid like random thoughts. I was wild, but loving tamed me. The keeper was mauled to death by the cougar she adored. She imagined they loved her back in their prison. The Stockholm syndrome only works for some. Others always await the door left ajar, the gate not locked securely. We are all prisoners of our desires, the lies we tell ourselves in bed, at work, at night. We build walls wondering why we can no longer see the mountains. But some never forget the long wind pushing at them, can wait years for a moment's lapse from a guard, those who will make it finally to those wild white mountains. A republic of cats. Nobody rules. They all take turns. I can never tell who will chase who, playing war over the couch and chairs, round and round again, till suddenly they stop as if a whistle blew in their heads. Five of them, aged 15 to 2, who will curl together, making one cushion of patchwork fur? Who will painstakingly lick a friend, washing and cuddling? Who will growl at their friend of last hour? The one rule is where each sleeps at night, their spot in the bed, and with whom it is written in bone. Contemplating my breasts. Strange. These soft lumps on my front, like men with their pricks, women whose breasts are large tend to be obsessed with you. We are always having to watch out for you, pick out bras with the care men spend selecting a new car. Can't lie on my stomach for long, watch you don't get bumped too hard, notice blouses won't button when otherwise they fit just fine. Men stare at them when addressing me as if my nipples were talking. Some of us are self-conscious, wearing muumuus and sweatshirts over layer and layer. Others seek clothes that show you off. My identity contains a streak of you, but I sometimes feel as if I walk around behind you like a person behind a parade float, just tagging along. Sins of omission. Suppose hell were a room where the lovers you broke up with, the spouses you left, the friends you discarded, all were waiting to question you with no time limit ever, but the explanations could last halfway into eternity. Who wouldn't sooner leap into a fire? There is no excuse for the end of love or for the fact that it never started its engine into that lovely roar. But just coughed again and again till you gave up and got out and went off. Some friendships are just not sturdy enough to bear the daily wear and weight. How to say, but simply you bored me. Then all the people you did not help, the ones you hung up on, letters unanswered, loans denied, calls not returned, that endless line will be snaking through the horizon, waiting to demand what you would not give, life's unpaid bills. Fine, okay. There are, now read two more. Let's see, where is that one? I found one of the ones I want to read. Oh, I want to do that one too. All right, three more. Actually! I have to read this because the rented lakes of my childhood. I remember the lakes of my Michigan childhood. In New England, they're called ponds. Lakes belong to summer, two-week vacations that my father was granted by Westinghouse when we rented some cavern. Never mind the dishes with spiderweb cracks, the crooked aluminum saucepans, the crusted black frying pans. Never mind the mattresses shaped like the letter V, old jangling springs, moldy bathrooms, low ceilings that leaked. The lakes were mysteries of sand and filmy weeds and minnows flickering through my fingers. I rode into freedom, alone on the water that freckled into small ripples, that raised its hackles in storms, that lay glassy at twilight, reflecting the sunset, then sucking up the dark. I was unobserved as a quiet doe coming with her fawns to drink on the opposite shore. I let the rowboat drift on the current, pleased, lying face up like a photographer's plate, the rising moon turned to a ghost. And though the voices called me back to the rented space we shared, I was sure I left my real self there, a tiny black pupil in the immense eye of a silver pool of silence. Now I've got to find the one I want. Ma, ever try to get a recipe from anybody in your family? My mother gives me her recipe. Take some flour, oh, I don't know, 2-3 cups, and then you cut in the butter. Now, some women, they make it with shortening, but I say butter, even though that means you have to have fish, see? You cut up some apples, not those stupid sweet ones. Apples for the cake, they have to have some bite, you know, a little sour in the sweet, like love. You slice them into little moons. No, no, like half a crescent moons, you aren't listening. You mix sugar and cinnamon and cloves. Some women use allspice till it's dark and you stir in the apples. You coat every little moon. Did I say you add milk? Oh, just till it feels right. Use your hands. Milk in the cake part. Then you pat it into a pan. I like round ones, but who cares? I forgot to say you add baking powder. Did I forget lemon on the apples? Then you bake it, well, till it's done, of course. Did I remember you place the apples in rows? You can make a pattern like a weave. It's pretty that way. I like things pretty. It's just a simple cake. Any fool can make it, except your aunt. I gave her the recipe, but she never got it right. And I, let's see, the suicide of dolphins. No one, not even the scientists who study you, knows why you beat yourselves, whole family groups, communities on our beige sand to gasp and die, unless the volunteers call phone to phone quickly in a spider web of summoning can keep you wet and push you into deep water again, like shoving a huge wet sofa. Some think it's disease or following your leader into danger or chasing fish into water too shallow so you run aground. An old fisherman said to me, they remember how they used to live on the land. They remember. We know nothing, but still we grieve. Is your act any more opaque than a friend who drinks himself into a fiery crash? Another who burnt his brain to a crisp on crack? A woman who could not walk out on her husband even after the 5th trip to the emergency ward, leaving only feet first after he shot her? Or my friend's daughter who hung herself at 15 because of names she was called, because of words on a computer screen? Because of a boy. We cannot stop each other, but still we grieve. Probably I should stop now, it's 8 o'clock. Okay. Okay? Okay, I'll do one more. The Art of Blessing the Day. Yes. What? Oh, not that one? I want that one. I want this one. This is a blessing for rain after drought, Come down, wash the air so it shimmers, a perfume shawl of lavender chiffon. Let the parched leaves suckle and swell. Enter my skin, wash me for the little chrysalis of sleep rocked in your plashing. In the morning, the world is peeled, is shining. This is the blessing for sun after long rain. Now everything shakes itself free and rises. The trees are bright as pushcart ices. Every last lily opens its silken thighs. The bees dance and roll in pollen, and the cardinal at the top of the pine sings at full throttle fountaining. This is the blessing for a ripe peach. This is luck made round. Frost can nip the blossom, kill the bee. It can drop a hard, green, useless nut. Brown fungus, the burrowing worm that coils in rot, can blemish it and wind crush it to the ground. Yet this peach fills my mouth with juicy sun. This is a blessing for the first garden tomato. Those green boxes of tasteless acid the store sells in January, those red things with the savor of wet chalk, they mock your fragrant name. How fat and sweet you are, weighing down my palm, warm as the flank of a cow in the sun. You are the savor of summer in a thin red skin. This is the blessing for a political victory, although I shall not forget that things work in increments and epicycles, and sometime leaps at half the time fall back down. Let's not relinquish dancing while the music fits into our hips and bounces our heels. We must never forget. Pleasure is real as pain. The blessing for the return of a favorite cat, the blessing for love return, for friends return, for money received unexpected, the blessing for the rising of the bread, the sun, the oppressed. I am not sentimental about old men mumbling the Hebrew by rote with no more feeling than one says Gesundheit. But the discipline of blessings is to taste each moment, the bitter, the sour, the sweet, and the salty, and be glad for what does not hurt. The art is in compressing attention to each little and big blossom of the tree of life, to let the tongue sing each fruit, its savor, its aroma, and its use. Attention is love. What we must give children, mothers, fathers, pets, our friends, the news, the woes of others. What we want to change, we curse and then pick up a tool. Bless whatever you can with eyes and hands and tongue. If you can't bless it, get ready to make it new.